But I don't want to kind of read all my notes because that would be kind of boring. So anyway, bear with me. And you can, Robert, you can roll the tape, unless he already has started. This morning I was talking with my husband who studied English at St. Olaf College, and I was telling him about how I view the history of the Israelis and Palestinians as a real tragedy, in a sense that it feels to me at many times as all of this was preordained. And Tom looked at me and said, well, that's what tragedy is. If it wasn't preordained, it would be pathos. So I guess maybe my original feelings were correct, that that it is a tragedy, in the sense that sometimes you get the feeling that that these two peoples, because of certain circumstances, would inevitably meet in this conflict, and that there would be a bloodshed and difficulty. And there's also then a part of you that says, well, if it is a tragedy, if it's a real true tragedy, then maybe it just has to work itself out. And if it is so preordained, what can we do to alleviate it? I don't know. But anyway, that was a thought that I had this morning. I think when we talk about history, we have to realize that everybody has a different view of it. They'd have a different perspective about it. And that's understandable because everyone comes to certain experiences with, or certain time in their life with specific characteristics that have caused them to feel the way they feel. The one thing that may not be terribly characteristic of this conflict, but what I have noticed in the past years has been that both sides seem to discount the history of the other. Maybe that happens in other situations where there is a struggle over land, a kind of situation that resembles what's gone on between the Israelis and Palestinians. But I have heard so many people speak through the years. They talk about their history, and they seem so totally incapable of recognizing what has happened to the other. It's been very difficult for Arabs and for Palestinians to understand the Holocaust, for them to really get into it, to have some kind of understanding of what happened to the Jewish people. It is as if I enter into that, if I understand that, if I feel any kind of empathy toward the Jews because of that situation, somehow my claims will, my historical claims will be diminished. So again, we talk a lot in that part of the world about the zero-sum game, which is anything that's good for you can't possibly be good for me.
What did you call it?
A zero-sum game. Anything that's good for you can't be good for me. And anything that's good for me can't possibly be good for you. So you have these two histories and these two peoples who just go past each other. And they don't meet. Because if they do possibly meet and they do recognize each other as human beings, they might have to, a Palestinian might have to understand or might have to feel empathy for an Israeli who has lost all of his or her relatives in the Holocaust. Or an Israeli might have to try to understand what it was like to be a Palestinian and have your land confiscated and lose everything. So that's again, I think, another tragic aspect of it, that these two peoples go right past each other. And they use...
Yes? Isn't also part of the problem is that they both take the same stand, that the Palestinians say, and then the Israelis say the same thing, that God gave his land to us.
That's more on the Israeli side. That's the argument that is used certainly from a history that we all know from our experience in Sunday school and church about the promise to Abraham, etc. The Palestinians, their claim is more on the fact that we were here all the time. You people left. You know, you were gone. But
weren't the Arabs part of God's promise to Abraham?
Well, certainly through Ishmael, but that's one of the things we'll talk about when we get to the Palestinian view of history. Ishmael was very much recognized as a son of Abraham. And it's very interesting to note something I had not noticed when I read through through some of those chapters in the Old Testament, that when Abraham is buried, who buries Abraham? Does anybody know? Isaac and Ishmael. They're both. They are named as the two who are at Abraham's burial. Now, after Sarah died, Abraham married again and had many other children. But the two who were there to bury him were Isaac and Ishmael. And, you know, we have this tendency to believe that Ishmael was just banished and thrown out of the desert and never heard from again. Well, that's obviously not the case. But also the Bible makes it very clear that the blessing, that God's promise, comes through Isaac and not Ishmael. So again, the Jews' claim is basically the promise that God made to Abraham. And the Arabs and the Palestinians say, yes, that's fine and dandy, good, but we're here. I have a friend in Ramallah, one of the cities just outside of Jerusalem, and she's a Christian. And she can trace her Christian Arab ancestries back for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So that's the difference in the claims. God gave it to us, yes, but we were here. This is the only home we know. Now I'm digressing again, and I shouldn't, but I have some problem. Now I'm going to talk about Zionism today. I have some problem with the discussion that goes on in some circles about whether Zionism is justified. Now, was it? A lot of people want to say, no, it's Zionism is evil, it shouldn't have happened, a number of things. I think at this point, that's a rather moot point, because I have another friend who is a retired colonel from the Israeli army. He was born there. He's now in his late 50s, I suppose. And he once told me, after we'd had a long conversation, that, you know, he said his parents came from Germany. And he was born in Rishon LeZion, one of the first Jewish settlements in Israel. And he served in every war. He's been a soldier since he was 17 years old. And now he's kind of the quintessential tired soldier. He doesn't want to fight anymore. He's very active in the peace movement. His daughter, in fact, has done something that is just outrageous in Israeli eyes, and that is that she's married a Palestinian, so he has interesting family gatherings. One son-in-law is a rabbi and the other one's a Palestinian. but anyway, he said, look, at the end of one of our conversations, look, the Zionist enterprise may have been wrong. It may have been the foolish, most stupid thing that could have happened. It might have been doomed from the very beginning. I don't know. But right now, that doesn't matter to me because I didn't ask to be born here. My parents came here. They were looking for a better life. They left Germany. They got out of Germany in time. They came here. I was born here. This is the only home I know. So whether it was right or wrong, you know, I have nothing to say about it because there's nowhere else for me to go. Where am I going to go? And the Palestinians, of course, say the same thing. Where else am I going to go? But one thing that this man says, Colonel Barone says, and he said it in this, after that, he said, I understand. You know, there's no place for me to go other than here, and yet I understand what my coming here has meant for the Palestinian people. Now you will hear very few Israelis that will ever say that, that will ever, how can I say it, that will ever make that kind of confession, that deep down inside they understand that as much as they felt they had to have a place to be, that in coming there, they caused a tremendous amount of pain and suffering for the people who are already there. Now, if only more people could understand that, if more Israelis would be able, I think, to articulate that, we'd be much further on the way to peace. And he went beyond that, and he said, I understand what my coming here meant for the Palestinians. And if and when the Palestinians will understand that I cannot be but who I am, and that is a Jew living here in this place, then I will fall down on my knees and I will ask them for their forgiveness because they deserve it. I mean, I was just bowled over when he said that. But again, there are very few Israelis that would ever, ever say that. Because their idea of Zionism, of course, it was so pure, it was such a dream, it was so necessary. How could it possibly, in a million years, hurt other people? Because their motives were so good. I mean, a lot of people have a tendency, I think, to think that somewhere in Russia or Poland or whatever before the turn of the century, there were people there who were simply plotting to take land away from poor, unfortunate Arabs. That wasn't the case. They may have had nationalistic tendencies. They may have wanted a state from the very beginning, but their motives really were not beyond reproach. Certainly there were good people and bad people in the Zionist movement like there is everywhere, but there was almost a naive attitude about the beginning of Zionist ideology. And now I've gotten far too ahead of myself.
How about the Jewish prayer next year in Jerusalem?
Well, that's part of it.
That's 2,000 years old.
It's 2,000 years old. And when circumstances in Russia and Poland before the turn of the century made life almost impossible for the Jewish communities there, of course they'd been saying this prayer for 2,000 years. And they then turn to the Palestinians now today and say, you say we don't have a right to be here? Well, okay, we were dispersed, but it happened against our will. You know, the Romans threw us out. We didn't ask to leave here. And how can you say we have no attachment to this country when every Passover for 2,000 years we've prayed next year in Jerusalem? But again, you know, you run into a situation where the other side has been hurt so much and has had so much tragedy happen to them because of the presence of these people that they don't want to listen to that. So what? Big deal, you know. It's very difficult. I'd like to begin by talking again about the history as a weapon that both sides have used very effectively against each other. And it kind of degenerates into this, I've suffered more than you. I mean, I cannot tell you the number of conversations and times I've sat with people in both Israel and the West Bank listening in to these long, almost diatribes. And it's... In the beginning, it was very hard for me to listen to it because I knew a lot of stuff that they were talking about was sheer mythology. I mean, a lot of the history that these people use against each other is myth. But yet, I realized that I had to listen, and I have never really tried to. Certainly, if it's somebody I know very well and I have a personal relationship, I'll say yeah, but. You know, don't give me that, you know what you're saying here isn't totally true. But you listen to people and it is again and again the litany of what happened to us and how bad the Jews were, how stupid the Palestinians are, or how bad they are, and on and on and on. And you realize, well, maybe you just gotta let it get out. But you do get tired of it. You get tired of kind of watching both of these people wallow in their victimization. And they seemingly love being made victims of history, and yet they stay there. In staying there and in constantly seeing themselves as victims, they have very little ability to deal with what is now. And that is the fact that both Israelis and Palestinians are there, and they are going to be there unless they totally obliterate each other. And I've always been very frustrated that they preferred being victims of history to being shapers of history. I mean, that question itself you could talk about for a whole day of the psychological manifestations or what happens to a person so that they cannot, because of their history, take control of it or move ahead, but are caught. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to meet one of my real heroes, who is a very well-known Israeli author by the name of Amos Oz. He's about 40, he's in his, I suppose, early 50s now, and he's a kibbutznik, and I wrote him a letter in Jerusalem. I'd read all of his books and thought that I'd never have a chance to meet him. Barbara Streisand, I'd been in Jerusalem and picked up the Jerusalem Post and read this little article that said Barbara Streisand had just visited him. I thought, ha, sure, you know, I'll never be able to visit him. But I wrote him a note, and out of the blue, a phone call came one day and said, do you want to come and talk to me? Okay, I come on Sunday. Oh. So then on Saturday night, I sat in my bed and shook all night trying to think of what I would say to this great man. Well, anyway, he turned out to be a very fine person and has remained a friend. But he's written a wonderful thing that I want to read to you that I think will, in a way, express the tragedy of this situation. It's a piece he wrote. This is a kibbutz movement magazine. I think he wrote it about 6 or 7 years ago, and it's called The Shadow of the Past. The shadow of the past looms over this entire conflict. It is Europe which spilled our blood and persecuted us unto the brink of despair. It is Europe which oppressed and exploited the Arab nations. And it is Europe that is responsible for the fact that each side sees before it not the face of his real enemy, but the shade of his tormentors and oppressors of the past. Only within the framework of Marxist mythology are all of the exploited and oppressed destined to develop brotherhood and unity between them. Other than in the songs of Bertolt Brecht, it is actually the humiliated and persecuted themselves who always tend, in blindness and anger, to seize each other's throats with an unbreakable grip. This is true of individuals, and it would seem, in the relations between nations as well. The Arabs and the Israelis, despite their false pride and their imagined stance of independence and all the other manifestations of a beggar puffing his chest out with pride, which are the main similarities between the two opposing groups, despite all of their poses, military, heroic, liberated, the Arabs and the Israelis are two beaten and humiliated tribes, downtrodden and wallowing in inferiority, even when that leads in its way to outbursts of arrogant boastfulness. It is because we are all beaten, debased, rebellious slaves who have only now emerged into freedom that the enmity between us is so deep and so bitter, and the mutual fear. The tendency to see in the enemy monsters out of the past, dressed up in new costumes who have come to perpetrate new horrors. The Arab is the Cossack, athirst for pogroms, who has wrapped himself in a kafia. The Zionist is the forerunner and bridgehead of white imperialism who oppresses, plunders, and humiliates through the power of his technological sophistication and who buys off the natives with cheap glass beads. In my judgment, there is a logical conclusion to all of this. What the Jews and the Arabs must do now more than anything else, if they truly wish to be rescued from the horror and to stop the killing, is to remove the stereotypes, to submit themselves to a painful measure of mutual scrutiny, what we called in the youth movements a conversation between souls. Not necessarily on the subjects of boundaries and disarmament, but on the essential question, what is it that makes us ascribe to our foe a superabundance of treachery and evil intention? More than anything else, we will need to discover a quality of creative imagination by whose power we may perhaps be able to discover a path which will contain neither the danger of destruction for the state of Israel nor exploitation and humiliation for the Arabs of Israel or its neighboring nations. I asked him that day about this piece and about the issue of, you know, what makes us ascribe to our foe a superabundance of treachery and evil intentions. It's history. It's a lot of very bad, bloody history. So why should we discuss history? I think it's important to discuss it as well as I'm capable, which is not that great, but anyway, we'll try. So we can have some kind of maybe a better idea of what actually happened so that we can also then better understand why people act the way they act or do the things that they do. Because people usually have rather good reasons for doing what they do and saying what they say. I don't want to take too much time. First, are there any questions at this point or any comments that anyone would like to make? Yes.
I saw a documentary about a month ago, I think. People's One Land. Did you see that?
We've got it here. Paul was nice enough to bring it.
It's fantastic.
Or I brought it. I'm sorry. Paul's got the other ones.
That sounds so negative. What is the name of this foundation? They're starting now working with the children. They showed these kindergarten kids.
Right. There is a kibbutz.
And they realized they both had one hand.
Right.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I don't remember the name of the foundation.
There are a number of those groups in Israel now. Basically, they are involved with relationships between Arabs and Israel and Israelis within Israel.
But starting at kindergarten level,
right.
And show high school groups, so
right.
That there is dialogue going on.
There is dialogue, but there is very little dialogue between, of course, the Palestinians of the West Bank, and especially now because of the uprising. There had been some solidarity committees before the uprising, but that's pretty much ended now. But this is basically, and I'm not saying, you know, that isn't equally important. It is terribly important because, as I said yesterday, if and when a peaceful solution comes, Israel's going to have to deal with that minority Arab population within its borders. And so anything that can be done at that point is really healthy. I also talked to a woman at the university in Haifa, a Jewish woman who's done this kind of thing, brought together groups of kids. There is a kibbutz, oh, gee. Do you know it, Paul? Outside of Jerusalem? That is an experiment. I know the name. I'll probably remember it before I'm finished. Is an experiment in Arabs and Jews living together.
Isn't it new something?
Neve Shalom? Yeah, Neve Shalom. Right. Did you go out there when you were there? You went past it. Yeah, right.
Are you familiar with the book Blood Brothers?
Yes, it's in the.
The author there writes about his father. Of course, he was a Christian man, and mm-hmm. seemed to think it was possible for the Jews and the Arabs to live well together in those communities. It was just when the military came and disrupted that then bitterness mm-hmm. arose again. Well, did you get a feeling for that the average person would be willing to live together, but it's government or other cities?
It's very interesting to see the differences in the generations. I would say that would be much more prevalent in the older generation. I have a good friend in the kibbutz where I live who is about 76 years old now. And he, again, was in all of Israel's wars and served for a time in the foreign service in Tehran. But he's one of those people who, you see, at the beginning came and had relations with the Arab neighbors. To this day, the land where my kibbutz is located, that land was purchased from a rather wealthy Arab family who simply wanted to sell some of their land. Now, this is obviously not the way a lot of land transfers happened. Many of the land transfers happened because there were wealthy landlords, many of them living in Beirut, who had tenant farmers on their land. And when the Zionist pioneers came, they had a lot of money because there had been fundraising going on all over the world for the Zionist enterprise. So they had the money. The Arab landlords, who really couldn't have cared less about the poor, unfortunate farmers who had lived on the land all these years, and who themselves felt, even though they didn't own the land, it was where they were born, where their children were born, where their fathers were born. Everybody had been born there, so while they didn't own it still, they felt it was theirs. The Jews paid incredibly high prices, inflated prices for the land. But that, of course, was the beginning of terrible anger and hate among the local people who were very much victimized by this whole situation and were tossed off land that, even though it didn't belong to them, they felt it was theirs. And one thing you have to understand about the Arab view of land, Arabs view land as something that is almost, it just transcends generations. It's more... We look at land, and the Western mentality looks at land as something, well, it's our home, but we can also sell it. That would never, never enter the Arab mentality. Sell your land, sell the place where you were born, where your children were born, where your parents were born. That's impossible. So again, what you have is a tragic, in a sense, confrontation between a culture that feels that way about land and then another culture which says God gave it to us. You know, there's very little room for compromise there. But it's two different versions of the land. But back to what I was saying about the older generation who seemed to get along better with their Arab neighbors. Number one, they learned to speak Arabic. My friend David speaks Arabic fluently. He had to, because in order for the kibbutz to make it financially, they were so poor when they came there in the early 30s, that he earned money for the kibbutz by plowing for the Arabs. I mean, so they had this kind of relationship. He learned Arabic. He understood the way Arabs thought. He respected Arabs, you see? He respected them because they were his friends, and he had daily relationships with them. That doesn't mean during the riots in the 30s, when people were taking pot shots at him down at the corner, that he wasn't angry at Arabs and that he had problems with them, but still he respected them because he had relationships with them. And it was very almost touching for me to hear him say that in the War for Independence in 1948, the Egyptian armies were coming up from the south, and everybody was most afraid. They were afraid of the Arab Legion from Jordan, but they were most afraid of the Egyptian army, which was going to swoop up from the south along the coast and run over Ashkelon and Ashdod and all these places. And our kibbutz was right in the way of that. The Arabs' neighbors went to him and said, if the Egyptians come, we will hide you. We will take you in because we know that you're going to be in danger. That's one generation, and that generation is now either gone or soon to be gone. The generation in its place has known the 48 war, has known the 67 war, has known the Yom Kippur war, and now even in the generation, let's say, the youngest generation has been influenced by these incredible right-wing nationalist ideas where Arabs are simply dirt. I mean, they're simply, you can't trust them. All the stereotypes are there. So instead of, you know, when you say, we talk about the chances for interaction between Arabs and Israelis, I think that's incredibly important at this young age, because most of them haven't the slightest idea how they feel or act. It's incredible when you think this tiny, small country, and this is what David Shipler says. I would suggest we'll try to play that videotape called Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in a Promised Land. David Shipler was the New York Times correspondent in Jerusalem for about 3 or 4 years, and after he left, he wrote this wonderful book. If you don't see the film, the book is now out in paperback, and it's one of the best psychological studies of this conflict I've ever read. How people can go day in and day out and rub shoulders with each other, and yet they don't even know each other.
What language do they have in common, or do they have
none?
None.
Not unless an Israeli will take the time to learn Arabic. Mostly it's the Arabs who will learn Hebrew because they need it in a practical sense. Yes?
When you're out talking to these people, and I know you don't like some of these comparisons I heard yesterday about, do they ever come back to you about how we treated the Indians in this country, the American Indians?
No, because most of them don't know that history. Some of the Israelis know it, but know that what the Palestinians will say is they'll question our kind of unthinking support of the State of Israel, and how can you do this when you know all this pain and suffering is happening to us. That's basically where they pin you down if you're an American.
Now, your author was referring to it, wasn't he, when you read about giving beads?
Right. See, yeah, he and Amos Oz has used this imagery in a number of his works. The idea
he must have been talking about.
Yeah. Well, he is a real, how can I describe him? He's an Ashkenazi. He's a, you know, a European mentality from, I think, German parents.
Quite apt, though, because it's almost as if the United Nations were to give the land back to the Indians, and how would Americans feel if they were dispossessed?
Mm-hmm.
And the Indians, I think, have the same feeling for the land of the Palestinians.
Yes, they do. Those kinds of pastoral people, I mean, certainly the Indians were hunters, but their relationship to the land was very close, the same way the Palestinians, because most of the Palestinians were tenant farmers. I mean, the land was not only their home and the place where they were born, but it was they made their living from the land. And when they were dispossessed, when they were thrown off the land, then a whole way of life really ended for them. They were forced into being hired laborers. They were forced into the cities to take jobs. And so you have to understand that a whole way of life, a whole culture, was also, in many ways, destroyed. So that's another real bitter issue for them. Okay, I was going to talk a little bit about history from from Abraham on, but forget that. That goes out the window. I'll just assume that we all know about coming from Babylonia and meeting God and having all the... Okay, and we'll skip the diaspora. But I guess there is one thing that I think is interesting. And when I was doing research for this... I was amazed at the numbers of people, and Paul knows this better than I do, the numbers of people who have gone through that area. I mean, it is a crossroads. There's a man by the name of Max Demont, who has written a book, The Jews, God, and History. It's not a real scholarly book, but it's a very readable book if you want to read history that is kind of lively and not really terribly boring, but forget the parts that he writes about the Israelis and Palestinians, because he's kind of too pro-Israel or on those things. But it is it's a good book, and I recommend it to you. But when he talked about the numbers of people who have been in that land, starting from the beginning, you got the Canaanites. They were the first. Then there were the Egyptians. Then there were the Hyksos. Then Egypt again, followed by the Hittites. Now we're up to about 1350 to 1290. Then Egypt again, 1290 to 1154. Then the Canaanites and the Jews and the Philistines, 1154 to about 1000. Then the short period of David, Solomon, the 10 tribes, Judah, etc., 1000 to 586. That's a pretty short time. Babylonians then. Then Alexander the Great, then Greece, then the Ptolemies, then the Jews again, the short period when the Jews reasserted themselves during the Maccabees, then the Armenians, and then the big guys, the Romans, from 63 BC to 614 AD. They were followed by the Persians, Rome again, the Arabs, Muslim invasion, Islam, the Turks, the Crusaders, the Egyptians again, the Turks again, Ottoman Empire, Great Britain after World War II, and finally the Jews and Arabs again, Israel and the state of Jordan. He says, he's got a great quote, he says, when finally, in the 12th century BC, the Jews settled in the country they could call their own, though there were other people living there all the time, namely the Philistines and the Canaanites, they used the worst possible judgment. They selected a strip of land that was a corridor for armies of warring empires. Over and over again, the Jews were to pay for this error of judgment. He calls it an error of judgment. I mean, it was a promise of God. By being decimated in battle, sold into slavery, or deported to alien lands, yet they showed up persistently at the same old place, building anew their little strip of real estate, which has been alternately called Canaan, Palestine, Israel, Judah, Judea, and now again, Israel and Palestine. When you look at all these people, these major groups who lived there, Egypt was there for 615 years. The Jews were there 414 years. The Romans, 677 years. The Arabs, 447 years. The Turks, about 400 years. And that, again, the time of David and Solomon was very short. The times when the Jews were totally in control.
Which of those major groups do the Palestinians connect as their groups?
Well, they were, in a sense, I guess you could look at them in the same way that maybe you looked at the Jews. There were a lot of people coming and going. You could say some of these Palestinians were are related to Philistines. They're related to people who were always there. They were Syrians, whatever. Paul?
Well, there are some, she was speaking last night also about reclaiming archaeology, and you'll see some Palestinians making connections with Canaanite culture. Some have shown that the houses that the Canaanites lived in show some similarities with the traditional Palestinian house, and that would indicate, you know, some kind of continuity culturally through there. But we can never talk about peoples in terms of race or ethnic identity, especially in a crossroads like this. There were so many comings and goings that it would be impossible for anybody, including the Jews, to maintain any kind of ethnic purity. In fact, as most people know, the Jews come in all colors, eye colors as well, and so forth. Just being born of a Jewish mother is the current good definition of a Jew, which allows for a lot of input. So it's equally true with the Palestinians. The fact that most of them, even the Christians, have Muslim names simply means that the most recent of these prolonged occupations has been from the conquest of Islam onward. And it's also somewhat misleading in that some of these groups that we're talking about here and the numbers of years that they were in political control often had relatively few numbers of that ethnic group who came in as the political controllers. Some brought with them many more peoples in terms of migrations. For example, there's probably more Arab blood that came in than Turkish blood. Turks often simply sent a governing class down there, and then they were transferred away later.
Rome
to a degree the same. Mm-hmm. But the Greeks, many more Greeks were there in comparison, say, to the Romans on an ongoing basis. So it varies. It's a tough question to answer.
And weren't, I mean, couldn't you also say that those people who are now call themselves Palestinians were as much victimized by these comings and goings as were the Jews?
Yeah.
I mean, they're, you know, here we live here, but boy, people are coming and going, and usually they're not very nice.
Just a footnote to his comment about an error of judgment. In another way, it was the only possible place. If you look at the Middle East as a whole, you remember that term, the Fertile Crescent. Well, the two ends of the Fertile Crescent are, of course, the Mesopotamian Tigris-Euphrates Valley and then the Nile Valley. Both of those are places where the oldest civilizations began and which were, therefore, the sources of resources that could build up large-scale empires and big, powerful states. Well, what happened with the middle of the Fertile Crescent, which is where Palestine, Israel is that depending upon the strength of powers in each end of the Fertile Crescent, that was the no man's land. That was the part that could be contested by an expansionary power from Mesopotamia or an expansionary power from Egypt, depending upon how strong they were at various times. And Israel as a kingdom arose at a precise time after two of these large empires had killed each other off after about 400 years of incessant warfare, the Hittites in the north and the Egyptians down there. Then there was a vacuum, and small kingdoms could arise there at various times when there was a vacuum, when there wasn't a big power from outside who could impose itself there. So in some ways, a small people like the Jews could only have constructed a kingdom, even if temporarily, in a place that was on the periphery of where big powers usually constructed their empires.
Right, and that time of David and Solomon was in this kind of vacuum, and then
here come the Assyrians first, and then come the Babylonians
coming back
out of there. Right.
So, I mean, in a way, it was a fortunate time that was the only reason that David and Solomon could exist was because of the weakness of their neighbors. One of the things I realize here is I wish that Paul and I had lived closer together. because I think maybe we can still do this together, and we had some conversations by phone before, but I think together we would do an extremely good job on this, because he's got all this really great, great historical stuff that I don't, and I've got kind of the psychological stuff because of relationships, but maybe we can still do this. It's really helpful. Thank you. Yes?
Could you introduce Paul?
Oh, I'm sorry. Paul Hansen, this is another thing that's really nice. We didn't know it when we had these discussions on telephone, but we were classmates from Luther College. We were in the same class in 1967, and I knew Dixie, of course, as well. And didn't realize that until we got on the bus. Paul teaches, his credentials are excellent. He left Luther College on a Fulbright to India and got his doctorate from the University of Chicago and now teaches at California Lutheran in the history department. And I tell you, go to his Islamic stuff. It's great. And maybe I hope he'll continue coming and help me out from time to time, fill in the spots that I need help on. Okay, Well, I think we have we've got about half an hour left. Okay. Now the diaspora happens. As I said, Romans kick the Jews out. They're not even allowed to be in Jerusalem. It's verboten. They're still around, though, small little communities around, but basically religious groups. And during all the time of the diaspora, there were Jews living there. A lot of Jews would come there to die because if they couldn't live there, at least they would come to die. And you see a lot of really old Jewish cemeteries around Jerusalem. So basically it was not any nationalistic reason. It was basically a religious one that they wanted to come back to Jerusalem to die. Now, the rise of what is known as Zionism. Zionism literally means a return to Zion. The original Jebusite stronghold in Jerusalem, when David came in, he defeated the Jebusites, and he captured the city, and he made Zion the symbol for Jerusalem itself. That's one definition of it. A more modern definition is simply the effort of the Jewish people to manifest themselves in a nationalistic way, meaning I have a good friend in Israel who talks about Zionism as the national liberation movement of the Jews. There is a Jewish-French author by the name of Rodinson, and he describes, he again talks about the kind of inbred tragedy here when he talks about Zionism and its effect on the Palestinians or the people who are already living there. He says, Palestine's tribulation stemmed from the fact that far away, men and women longed for her and were ready to die for her, like lovers pining for an absent mistress. This loving and this longing, of course, is we talked about in the prayer next year in Jerusalem, which went on uninterrupted for 2,000 years. What made a Zionism more of a historical necessity instead of simply a kind of undefined longing, I guess can be traced specifically to events in Poland and in Russia before the turn of the century. How many of you know what the word pogrom means? Okay. Oh yeah, right, exactly. Well, that's very good because you put that all in context, and that's exactly the kind of situation where the ideology of Zionism arose from or came out of. Before the turn of the century in the 1880s, there was a czar in Russia whose father had been assassinated. And whether or not it was an assassination by a Jew, we don't know. But anyway, he decided that he was going to take his anger out on the Jewish communities, the defenseless Jewish ghetto communities in Russia at the time. And these pogroms were really quite horrible things. The first pogrom was in 1881, and by the end of the year, 215 different communities had been hit by pogroms. They left about 20,000 people homeless. ruined economically about 100,000 people, property destroyed, estimated about 80 million. Not many people were killed, but it was usually this kind of totally just violent looting, destroying, smashing of property, raping, beating up people. In some sense, there was some murder, but it was mostly just crazy, wild violence. The response was that some simply waited it out, some simply suffered, but as you saw in Fiddler on the Roof, some people said, hey, let's get out of here. And the place they went was the United States in huge, huge numbers. Most American Jews today can trace their ancestors from Russia and Poland, and they came at that time. In the 1880s, 135,000 came. In the 1890s, 279,000 came. And the first decade after the turn of the century, 704,000 Jews came to the United States. There were, however, some people obviously just simply survived and stayed, or else there wouldn't be a Jewish community. I mean, obviously those that stayed in Poland were decimated during the Holocaust, but those in some stayed in Russia. Then there was a third group, and these are the Zionist ideologues. They had played quite an interesting role in the Russian Revolution. These people were hated not necessarily just because they were Jews, but also because they were the intellectuals. They were the liberal thinkers. They were the sons and daughters of the Enlightenment who, instead of kind of seeing their identity in terms of religion, I mean, this was a time when a lot of sacred things were bashed because of scientific discoveries, and the church felt threatened by this. They were threatened by science. They and the government certainly were threatened by ideals of socialism and democracy and all the rest. So that was another reason why these people were hated. And many of them played a very interesting role, a very important role, in the first Russian Revolution that failed. And after that, they had played such a major role in it, and again, anti-Semitism came down, and they were again discriminated against. So finally, they said, "Okay, if our liberal ideas can't work in the context of a revolution in Russia, we'll take the whole thing and go somewhere else." Again, along with this was the idea of we are stateless. There is no place for us to be safe. The only place we can be safe is in our own land, where we can behave like any other people. And where's that land? Of course, it has to be Palestine. There's no choice about that. One of the early Zionist writers, Leon Pinsker, wrote a book called Auto-Emancipation. And he said there, "The Jew is the stranger par excellence. Other strangers have homes to go back to. The Jew has no home of his own, and because of this, is an object of particular aversion in other people's homes. Jews must realize that the aversion is permanent." A lot of intellectual Jews, European Jews at that point in time, had felt very assimilated, quite very much a part of the culture. They usually weren't religious. They were very sophisticated, et cetera, et cetera. The father, who we call the father of modern Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was this kind of person. Herzl lived in Europe from about 18, I think he was born in 1860. He died in about 1904. He didn't live very long. He wasn't an old man when he died. But he was a journalist in Vienna and was in Paris covering the trial of a man by the name of Dreyfus, which took place in 1894. Dreyfus was an officer in the French army and had been really framed. They found it out later that he had been framed. But he was accused of treason and, in fact, was sent to Devil's Island. What frightened Herzl so much during this experience, which he covered as a journalist, the trial, was that because Dreyfus was a Jew and because this was a trial for treason, all of this kind of subliminal anti-Semitism came roaring out of the populations. There is a scene where Dreyfus is stripped of his rank. You know, they pull the epaulets, is that what they call them? Pull them off. And the crowds were screaming Judas and this and that and whatever, which, of course, would not have happened if he hadn't been anything but Jewish. And at that moment, Herzl, who had, as I said, been a very assimilated kind of ho-hum Jew, said, you know, this is something terrible. This means that a person who has risen to this point in the army and who is looked at as a hero and falsely accused and now degraded in public like this, this means that I'm in danger. If he's in danger, I'm in danger, and there's no place for us to go, and we've got to have a home. It was interesting to note that during some of the discussions that took place in the Zionist congresses, at that point then Zionists started meeting. A lot of the meetings were held in Switzerland before and after the turn of the century, that there was a point where a decision was almost made to go to Uganda because there was land available in Uganda. But in the end, majority said, why Uganda? We have nothing, there's no relationship there. Now I'll talk a little bit about the naivete of the Zionist movement. One of the kind of slogans of the movement, if you can use that term, was a land with no people for a people with no land. I mean, just think of that. A land with no people, Palestine. Nobody's there for a people with no land. Jews, there's no land. And again, you must understand that this isn't devious. This was a belief that was shared by a lot of people, not only Jews. It was shared by a lot of colonialists as well. Rodinson writes something very interesting. He says, throughout all this, the actual inhabitants of Palestine were ignored by practically everybody. The philosophy prevailing in the European world at the time was without a doubt responsible for this. Every territory situation outside that world, the European world, I mean, the Europeans, we are the center of the world. Everything out there is, well, we don't know. It was considered empty. Not of inhabitants, of course, but constituting a kind of cultural vacuum, and therefore suitable for colonization. And in fact, the European nations were able to impose their will in most parts of the world without too much difficulty. It was this idea that, yeah, well, there are people there, but our culture is so superior and good that they'll just love us. I mean, we'll go there, and the whole white man's burden idea was born at this time. And it was the same kind of idea that affected affected Zionism. So tragedy, in a sense, marks the Zionist movement from the beginning. It was this misunderstanding of the real situation. It was not devious on the part of the early Zionists. They were driven by necessity. Where were they going to go? What were they going to do? They had to do something. They saw themselves as the native children of Israel returning to their homeland, but to the people already in the land, they were seen as yet another manifestation of European colonialism and domination. And the Zionists, again, Herzl too, felt, well, our coming there, there are people there, but our coming there is only going to be good for them because we'll teach them all these wonderful things. We'll teach them technology and this and that, and they, you know, we'll only improve their lot. There were, however, some people in the Zionist movement who realized that there would be trouble from the very beginning, and there were also people, certainly among the Palestinian community, that knew that, who had the ability to see very far down the road and realize that there, sooner or later, there would be a tremendous clash coming. One of the Zionists was a man by the name of Ahad Aham, and he he was quite an interesting person. And in as early as 1891, he wrote, "The Arabs see no future danger for themselves in anything we do, and some of them profited from selling their land. Basically landlords, however. If ever there comes a time when we shall have developed our life in the land of Israel to the point where we shall be encroaching upon them in a greater or lesser degree, then we should not expect them to yield their places easily." So here was a person who as early as that realized that there was a potential of difficulty coming. There is another quote, and I'm sorry I can't remember who it was, but again, it was one of these, well-meaning Zionist intellectuals who is quoted after having heard that there were other people there, kind of ran through one of the Zionist congresses saying, "But my God, there! I didn't know it. You know, there are people there. This is going to mean that we're going to have trouble." But he was one of the very, very few people who saw that coming. That it literally came as a surprise to him. Herzl, who's the father of Zionism, demonstrates this typical naive attitude when he talks about the financial rewards that would come to Arabs from selling their land to Jews. But again, here's the clash of Eastern and Western culture. Land for Arabs, as I said, has always meant more than just simply money. Herzl said, "Do you believe that an Arab who has a house or land in Palestine, whose value is 3,000 or 4,000 francs, will greatly regret seeing the price of his land rise 5 or 10-fold? For that is necessarily what will happen as the Jews come. And this is what must be explained to the inhabitants of the country. They will acquire excellent brothers, just as the Sultan will acquire loyal and good subjects who will cause the region, their historic motherland, to flourish." We'll make the desert bloom. How can any of this be bad? And Herzl, I think he honestly believed the first part. I think he honestly believed the first part about that the Arab population will so benefit from our know-how, from Western culture and Western technology, but he did not believe the second part, because from the very beginning, the idea was that there would be a Jewish homeland and that it would be a state. There were some in the Zionist movement who from the beginning talked about a binational state, meaning that the Jews would come there and together with the Palestinians form some kind of national entity. But after the Arabs began to be very frightened by the high numbers of Jewish immigration, and then clashes began in the 30s and even before that time, that idea kind of flew out the window. So it was not to be seen again. It's about a quarter of. Any more questions?
We have to go, but quickly, Herzl was a secular Jew.
Yes.
And his wife was religious. And she had some influence on this selection of Palestine as the land that they would go to.
I didn't know that.
How much influence did religious Jews have upon the formation of Zionism if Herzl was at its head as its leader?
Very little, I think. It was basically a secular movement. Certainly, in the eyes of the very ultra-Orthodox Jews, who to this day, it's crazy when you go to Israel. There's the very right-wing Netuy Karta party, which is constantly doing things like sending letters to King Hussein of Jordan and say, "Come with your armies and take it back again, because this." This state has been instituted not by the Messiah, but by people. What is happening, in essence, is that the state of Israel, existing as a modern state instituted by people, is holding up the coming of the Messiah. So there was, to some extent, very much of a negative view on the part of some of the religious groups. But again, the religious groups there were so small and rather pathetic. I mean, all they did was read the Torah. They weren't interested about anything else. And the other group of religious people, certainly the Jews in the United States at that point, though they had gone, they had immigrated to the United States, and some of them obviously were religious, were pretty happy with the way things were going. They thought, oh, well, okay, you know, Zionism, it's a pretty good idea, but, you know, we've just moved here and we're happy here, so don't bother us. The other group that stayed on, I mean, that were religious in terms of life in Europe and Poland and whatever, of course, were lost in the Holocaust. And by the time that the Holocaust was finished, those that had survived, they just wanted to get out and get there. They didn't, so religion really played not a particularly large role in it at all. For them, it was just, we don't know, we just know that everybody in the family was killed and we're alive and we better get out of here. So,
one
yeah,
the,
go
one
ahead.
One of the many ironies in the history here is that because assimilation wasn't really a possibility for Eastern European Jews in Russia, but it seemed to be a possibility in the West, in France, Germany, and England, that for years, Jews had resisted assimilation all through the Middle Ages because assimilation meant converting to Christianity, because it was Christendom. It wasn't any national state. But after the 19th century, when nationalism became a new form of identity for the first time, then the prospect was there, well, you could become a German, you could become an Englishman, you could become a Frenchman. But that feeling of nationalism wasn't possible in Russia because of the development of political institutions comparable to embody the national state didn't exist there. So assimilation and conversion began after it was no longer insisted upon. When Jews no longer were required to convert to assimilate, they began to convert, like Disraeli. If you think of 19th Marx, Jews like that in the 19th century voluntarily gave up Judaism and converted for careerist reasons and other kinds of things because it was no longer seen to be part of one's essential identity in Western Europe, to have a religious identity. Then when, as Carol says, at the end of the 19th century, nationalism had become so intense that economic crises, other kinds of competitions had resulted in squeezes within these countries and scapegoats and people who can't share all the pie. Then this anti-Semitism comes back, and people who thought they'd assimilated after three or four generations found that residual anti-Semitism was there, but they were now secularized. And so the Western European Zionists were essentially secular. The Eastern European ones, especially those who stayed, were essentially religious because they'd been forced to remain in religious ghettos. Ghettos still existed in the East, but they didn't in the West. And those two strands, they needed both. Herzl was the propagandist par excellence, had all the connections, really was the person who could run the things. But in order to provide the numbers, they also needed to recruit the support from